Good evening to you. Bob and Sarah were in a dimly lit hospital room. Sarah was by his bed, his death bed, and Bob was fading rather quickly. She was crying. He said, "Sarah, I've got to get something off my chest." "No, no," she said. "Save your strength. Don't speak." "No, you don't understand. I must say this. It's okay, you don't have to talk. Please, just let me say it. I've been unfaithful to you. There's been another woman." She said, "You don't have to tell me that. I know all about that. Why do you think I poisoned you?" I think it's a terrific idea to have a seminar, a lectureship on marriage, don't you? And the family? Don't we need this? You know what's happened to us, I guess, is that, I mean, we got problems in the church. We have problems among Christians in our homes, and sometimes they're very, very serious problems. And how do you explain it? Well, I suppose from one perspective, it's not so surprising. There's a very large segment of our society now which has completely abandoned marriage. They just don't get married. Don't bother. You have another segment of our society that's decided that marriage doesn't have to be between a man and a woman necessarily. And then all other segments have some struggles with the kind of commitment that is involved in having a really great family and a really great marriage. Our problem, it seems to me, is that we have forgotten that marriage is not a secular concept borrowed by Christians. It is rather a God concept sometimes borrowed by people of the world. Amen. It belongs to God. Our mistake is that we've listened to the wrong counselors. We've listened to the wrong advice. So the first Psalm says, "Blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly." I suppose we've done that. I mean, maybe with reference to our families, we've spent so much time listening to Oprah or to Phil or Hugh, those eminent theologians. And we've gotten away from God's way. The passage incidentally goes on. You know what the opposite is between, the opposite of listening to the world, to ungodly people about counsel or for counseling, you know what the opposite of that would be? Go back to the text in Psalm 1. "Blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful." Watch now. "But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night." That's the secret. And so tonight, what I want to do, if you please, is set the stage for the lectureship by saying that every session is going to be based on this one premise. It's that successful family has to be rooted in the Word of God. That's it. Do you know that the most successful, the best husband in the world is a faithful Christian? The best wife in the world is a faithful Christian. Now, if you don't believe that, you've come to the wrong place, because that's what this is going to be. That's what this is going to be about. That's what this is. Now, I want to talk about seven tools tonight, and I want you to open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5. Seven tools, and I'm going to name these, hopefully to make them memorable. And what I want to do is to just establish this principle that faithful Christianity will also make us great spouses. Now, I know that's a very broad concept. I'm going to get a lot more specific as we get along in this. But if you want to be a great spouse, where you have to start is being a great Christian. That is to ingest and to practice the kind of things that Jesus taught us to be and the ways he taught us to act. And when you do that, listen, you're going to line yourself up to be a great husband or a great wife. Now, number one, I want to drop down in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 21. Here's the bitterness drain. We're talking about some tools. Reach in your toolbox. And the first one is the bitterness drain. Jesus said this, "You have heard that it was said of those, or to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you," in other words, he's going to say something that's somewhat different. "I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,'" and Raca means empty-headed one, "shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." So Jesus said, you know that murder is wrong. Why is murder wrong? What is murder? Can you define murder? How would you define it? Murder is, this is my definition, murder is the deliberate taking of innocent human life. Right? Where I come from in Alabama, a lot of deer hunters, a lot of guys like to hunt deer. And I haven't personally, I mean, I've been deer hunting. I've never actually even scared a deer, much less killed one. But suppose you went out and killed a deer. Is that murder? It's taking of life, but it's not murder because it doesn't fit the definition. Deliberate taking of innocent human life. What if you drive your car tonight and somebody steps off a curb and you kill somebody? Is that murder? No, why not? Well, because it's not deliberate taking of innocent human life. It's accidental. What about capital punishment? Is that murder? No. Well, it doesn't fit the definition because it's not the deliberate taking of innocent human life. It's guilty human life. What about abortion? Wait a minute. Does it fit the definition? Deliberate? Well, I suppose it's deliberate. You got to pay for it. The deliberate taking of innocent, you'll never find anybody more innocent than a baby. Deliberate taking of innocent human, well, it's not an animal. Life, well, if it wasn't alive, you wouldn't be wanting to kill it. Jesus says, you know that murder's wrong, but I don't want you just not to murder somebody. I don't want you to treat people like they're worthless. Yeah, you have other principles in the Bible that point to this very thing. And here's the point that I want to make of this. And see, you say, well, that's not about marriage particularly. No, I suppose it's not. And yet, what I want to say is that what makes a man a great husband is also what makes him a great Christian, right? So here's the point. When we let bitterness get into our marriages, we really have trouble. What's bitterness? Bitterness is when I take some infraction, some quarrel that we've had, and I hold on to it, and I nurture that inside of me. And it may be that you, my spouse, you know, you apologize for it, and maybe I even say I forgive you, but the fact of the matter is I'm going to save it up, and when we have another argument, and it won't be very long, I'm going to let you have it with it. I'm going to remind you of this. And that's bitterness. And sometimes, you know what, in marriage, we can get into a nasty old habit of just being sort of sour toward our spouse. Are you sour towards your spouse right now? Are you? Here's Ephesians 4 and 32. "Be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another." How much? "Even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you." I know that. You say, I know all about that. I'm a Christian. I know that Christians are kind and tenderhearted and forgiving and all of that sort of thing. Fine, that's great, but I want to ask you a question. Is that applicable to my marriage? And is it true? Do you suppose it's true that there's one set of rules outside the closed doors of marriage and there's another set of rules in how I treat my spouse? Funny thing is, there's only one set of rules. Right? And so here's Luke 17 and verse 3. And it says this. If your brother sins against you, rebuke him. And if he repent, you know what the rest is? Forgive him. And if, are you ready for this? And if it happens 7 times in a day and he repents, I want you to forgive him. You say, wow, that's what it means to be a Christian. Great. It also is what it means to be a husband or a wife. Are we doing good at that? We're talking about the tools of marriage. The first one is the bitterness drain. Number two, ready? Let's go down to verse 27. I'm still in Matthew chapter 5. I'm going to call this one the lust hammer. The lust hammer. My Lord said in 27, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. What's wrong with adultery? I mean, the answer is, and you know, is that you stood before God and before those witnesses and you vowed to hold a matrimony, that I'll be faithful to you and only to you until one of us dies, no matter what. You suppose that if two people, a husband and wife, were secluded alone on a deserted island, that either of them would commit adultery? You'd say, well, I don't think so. There's no one with whom to commit adultery. That's right. And you know what? That's what Jesus is teaching here. When you marry, you say, I don't see anybody but you. I don't have eyes for you. Now, I could spend a whole session on this, and I'm not going to do it. We're only going to be here till about 11. And so, I'm just kidding. I don't mean it. But I'm telling you, pornography is a terrible disease. It's chewing away. It's a cancer in America right now. Internet's a great thing. Man, what a great tool. When I was a boy, you know, I suppose I know pornography existed. But back then you had to do something more to get to it. I suppose you'd have to go to some place and buy it. You'd run the risk that somebody would see you. You might go to some seedy theater somewhere, and I suppose, but you know, there's a kind of a built-in resistance to it. The devil has seen to it to take that away. And it gets to us psychologically, because a whole lot of men, even Christian men, who argue that I'm a sanctified man, we rationalize our way into sin. And I can dabble in this, and it's not going to hurt me. I can enjoy this sometimes. Sometimes I'll click on some of those sites, and I'll just take some joy in that. But it doesn't hurt me, because I told you I'm a Christian. I told you I'm a sanctified man. And you know what? All that's a lie from hell. All that's just a lie. The fact of the matter is that the use of pornography is a drug. And it is as difficult to overcome when a man becomes addicted to that. You say, well, I'm not addicted. Fine, let's see if you are. Here's what I want you to do. I mean, if anybody in here is looking at it, I don't know it. If you're using pornography or viewing pornography, and incidentally, and we ought to say this plainly, the use of pornography in any amount is a sin against God. I do not know how you could more accurately describe pornography than what Jesus said in verse 28. Because pornography, at its root, has the purpose of looking on a woman to lust after her. I know there's some of that that's reverse gender, but predominantly, of course, it's about naked women. And that's just it. Here's what I want you to do. Vow to God, I'll never do it anymore. Vow to God. So tell Him, I know that this is a sin. I'm sorry. It's a sin against my marriage. It's a sin against my wife. How would you like to be married to a man who is looking at pornography, to these models, and try to mentally compare your... Is he comparing me to her? Is he comparing me to them? How would you like to live like that? It breaks trust. And I'm telling you that trust is the very root of your marriage. You cannot survive in marriage without trust. It becomes hollow and meaningless. And pornography chisels away at that. Vow to God, I won't do it anymore. I'm going to quit. Cold turkey, just quit. But if it turns out that a couple of weeks from now, or perhaps less, whatever, you find yourself under some stress, maybe late at night, hard day, all alone, and you click that key again, then there's something that has gotten a hold of you because you vowed to God and couldn't do it. A couple of things you can do. One is that you can get some porn blocks for your computer. Very inexpensive, easy to do. I know those are get-aroundable. But then in addition to that, what you can do is to get an accountability partner. Find somebody. And I prefer it not being your wife. Maybe you think that would be the best. I think it should be somebody else. But it can't be a close friend either, because we have a tendency to violate things with close friends. After all, he's going to be my friend no matter what. What you need is somebody who you highly esteem, who you would not want to disappoint, who you maybe somebody you fear a little bit because you think so highly of them. That'd make a great accountability partner. And the way that it works and I've been doing it with guys for years, is that every day they have to call. Do it about noon. We use code language, and they say, I'm 100%. What that means is in the last 24 hours, with God as my witness, I haven't deliberately viewed pornography. The last 24 hours. So it's a resistance that we're building so that when that crisis moment comes and you have that opportunity, you think, I got to talk to him. I'm going to have to call him tomorrow at noon. I don't want to disappoint him. And I don't want to disappoint my God. And you get up and you do something else. Right? I held a meeting one time in Virginia. And after worship on Sunday night, we had a potluck, and we had a great time. And I happened to be thrown in together with a man who is a police officer in Richmond, Virginia. At the time, he was working at night, and he worked the worst part of town. And he told me that every night, his weapon would be out of his holster several times. I don't mean that he fired it every night. I mean that he used it as a threat every night. And he was a faithful Christian. He said, I'm going to range tomorrow. Target shooting. You want to go? Yes. I would love to go. And so I didn't have a pistol or anything, any kind of firearm with me, but I like to shoot them and just for fun. And so he said, I'll bring them. And so we met out there. We're the only ones out there on the range. There was this target out there, and in my mind, I thought, I'm a pretty good shot. I mean, I haven't had any formal training, but I'm pretty good at this. And I thought, it would be interesting, I think, to sort of compete with him, to hold my own with a trained professional. And so we got out there. I mean, I didn't say that, but I was thinking that. He said, there were several, he said, just choose which one you want. Oh, I think the 38. I'd go right ahead. And so I squared up. And I took my aim and I pulled back the hammer and I pulled off a shot. And then I aimed again and took my time and pulled off a shot. And when all six were fired, my pattern was pretty good. Again, I didn't say anything. I'm not boastful. Laid it down. You go. And the gentleman walks up to the table, and he turns his back to the table. And I thought, what is he doing? And he whirls around, he grabs the gun, he slaps the magazine in, he cocks it, and he empties the gun faster than I've ever seen anybody pull the trigger. And all of it was a lightning flash. It just happened so fast. And his pattern was just like this. It was so tight. And I thought, I'm so glad I didn't tell him what I was thinking. I know you're wondering, how does this relate? It relates like this, and it's very serious. Listen to this old preacher. When you click on pornography, you think you're on level ground. You think, I'm a guy, I'm looking at some pictures, I'm controlling this, level ground. That is not true. Do not think that the people who put that on are not professionals at what they do. I'm talking about marketing professionals. They know how a man thinks. They predict your actions. They're going to hit you as hard as they can with everything they've got. And do you know, of course, you do know why. And it's because of dollars. They want the dollars to change hands. And they know they got to hook you to do that. You're not dealing with amateurs, and it's not fair. And I want you to be scared of it. Because otherwise, you're going to get in a trap. And the deeper you go, the longer and harder it'll be to get out of it. All right, let's go back to the Bible. Drop down to verse 29. Well, the sacrifice booster. Here's a tool. Jesus said, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. Cast it from you. It's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Cast it from you. It's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Now, he's not talking about your literal eye or your literal hand. Your hand or your eye isn't sinful. It's the mind behind it that can be sinful. And what he's talking about really is very simple. It's that sometimes we have pet sins. And sometimes we let Jesus come so far with us in our lives, but we don't let him influence us with reference to those pet sins. And so in the context, what he's saying here in the Sermon on the Mount is if you have something in your life that is sinful, even if it's so precious to you, and you know sin can be really precious to a person. It may be as precious as your eye or your hand. You've got to sever that. You've got to cut it off. I think that's applicable to marriage. You say, I understand that. I'm a Christian. That's right. Well, let's apply it to our marriage. Is there something in your life of a sinful nature that is hurting you? If it's sinful, it's hurting you. But also is disruptive to your marriage. In Ephesians 5 and 25, Paul says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. You know what? That's a rather extreme statement, isn't it? He could have just said, husbands, love your wives, and then I could define how I wanted to love my wife, but he didn't. Even as Christ loved the church, that makes it hard. But the next statement pushes it to the max, and gave himself for it. That is to say, I'm to love my wife enough to die for her. Right? There cannot be anything in my life that I wouldn't be willing to give up for my wife except my relationship with Jesus Christ. If what I'm doing is interfering with my marriage, I could be stubborn. I could be really, she knew I liked to go fishing before she married me. Right? Are you crazy? If it's interfering with your marriage, give it up. Give it up. Right? Go to the next one. Verse 31. This one is of course, very clearly attached to the subject of marriage. In fact, it's about divorce. Furthermore, verse 31, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality or fornication causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. And if you want to talk some more about some of those issues after the session is over tonight, I'll be happy to, or others will be happy to talk to you about that. But let's talk about the divorce vac. Jesus says, I want you to stay away from divorce. Here's a circumstance under which you can divorce and remarry and still have a God-approved marriage. But he's warning us about divorce. Now, I want to give you some P's to keep you away from divorce. Anytime you think about the question of divorce, and this is really good for those of you who are not married yet. We've got a lot of folks here who are young and not married. We need to quote Barney Fife. You know what Barney says, don't you? Nip it in the bud, right? What we've got to do is to take precautionary measures to protect our marriages against adultery and against divorce. How do you do it? Number one, be present in your marriage. Be present. I understand that we're in a wartime, and we have a lot of men and women who are defending our freedoms and thus are separated from their spouses for extended periods of time, and I'm very thankful for those people and the sacrifices they're making, and I know that you are too. But I want to say to you that when I have a choice, I should choose not to be apart from my spouse for extended periods of time. 1 Corinthians 7 talks about this, and it says, and I'm just sort of paraphrasing in my own words, if you're apart from your, you just apart for long periods of time, the devil will get the memo, and he will put temptation in your way. I was sitting at my desk one Monday morning after our Sunday worship, and I was looking at visitor cards and writing letters and so forth, and there was this card in there from my wife, and she had checked the box, request a visit from the minister. I want to assure you, I took care of that. Be protective of your marriage. Now, I'm going to give you a rule. and this is not complicated, but it's very important that everybody in this room who's married or ever will be married, I want you to adopt this rule. Anytime you're with a member of the opposite sex and something is said or done that makes you feel uncomfortable, always say something of a positive nature about your spouse right then. Isn't that what Joseph did with Potiphar's wife? He said, "Now look, lady, everything in this house your husband has given to my hand except you." What he did was to psychologically reach out and bring Potiphar into that room. What I want you to do is to say something of a positive nature about your spouse. And you say, "Well, I don't know if she really means anything. I mean, it sounds kind of like a double meaning statement, like an innuendo or something. I don't care if she means it or I don't care if he means it or not. There's nothing wrong with ever saying something positive about your spouse. Say something positive about your spouse." I was in a hospital one day, tall hospital, visiting. Elevator, first floor, nobody on there but this woman and me. I was minding my own business. I know the elevator rules. Don't talk on an elevator. Just listen to that music. It's very soothing. Riding up on the elevator, just the woman and me, just the two of us together in the elevator. She said, "You smell good." She was right about that. I did. But it felt kind of funny that she said it. And I said, "Well, thank you. You know, my wife gave me that cologne. It's her favorite cologne." And she said, "Isn't that nice?" "Yes, it is. Yes, it is." Elevator door opens up and have a nice day. Have a nice day. Now, I'm not here to tell you that she meant anything unseemly by that. I'm just saying it felt a little personal, and it kind of gave me in Alabama we say the heebie-jeebies. That's what it gave me. And that night when I pillowed my head, I want to tell you that I didn't feel guilty about what I said to that woman or how I felt about that woman or anything in relation to that woman. You know why? Because I said something right then about Cindy. Right? Be protective of your marriage. Here's another P. Ready? Be positive in your marriage. I want you to find one thing every day you can compliment about your spouse. I want you to think right now. If you have complimented your spouse about anything today, would you raise your hand? Think about it. Not a hand. And oh, there's one soul. Two. Good. Have you complimented anything about your spouse today? A few. Okay, now you're making it up. Okay, now. Okay. I saw a hand that meant, "I wish I had." That's good. Hey, look. You want to protect your marriage? Do the little things. And what I want to assign you tonight is that every day I want you... Now, don't make it up. I'm not talking about cheap flattery. I mean something that's bona fide, something real. You think it, just do it. I mean, gentlemen, do you have a magic drawer at your house? That's what I call it. I've got a magic drawer in my chest of drawers. And the magic drawer always has underwear in it. And socks. And t-shirts. Mine. And it never goes away. Every time I go to that drawer and open it, those things are there. And they're folded and stacked. It's my magic drawer. You have a magic drawer? Have you thanked her for that? Have you ever said, "You know what? I love you. You do a great job with the magic drawer." Or, I mean, what is it that you can compliment about her every day? And why haven't she been doing it? And what is it you can compliment about? This is something that's good for goose, good for the gander, right? It feels good both ways, and it just sweetens the atmosphere. I want us to get out of the habit of this negativism where we save up these little grudges and we get this kind of habitual sour disposition when I'm around him. That's a nasty old habit, isn't it? It'll kill you. And I'll tell you something else, too. You will not live long enough. You have an expiration date on your body. You don't live long enough to waste time being unhappy in your marriage. Why should you do that? I don't want you to have a miserable marriage. I don't even want you to have a mediocre marriage. I want you to have music in your marriage. And we can, you know. Be positive in your marriage. Be polite. Are you polite? I don't have to be polite. She's my wife. Where'd you learn that? And where'd we get away? Why do we get away from this? Why do you teach your children to be polite? Teach them thank you, excuse me, please. Why do you teach your children that? And the reason is because you want them to think about the comfort of other people around them and not merely to think selfishly of themselves. Is that principle applicable to my marriage? Do you say thank you to your spouse? Do you say excuse me and please? If you bump into each other in the hallway, do you say excuse me? You open door for your wife? I'm going to tell you something. There are men right now who are more apt to open the door for a perfect stranger than for their own wife. Is that you? It is. What, did you open her door tonight? Now, ladies, you listen to this old preacher. Here's what I want you to do. Gentlemen, don't listen to this. Don't listen. Ladies, I just want you to wait. When you pull up into the church parking lot, just sit there. You know what's going to happen, don't you? I mean, he'll walk up the way, look around. He'll come back and get you. I promise, he'll come back. Now, the problem is that if I talk to men about this, they're going to try to do it, but she'll be out of the car before he gets around there. And what good is that? I want you to be polite. You say, well, that's real simple. Oh, yeah, it is. But it'll sweeten the air. It sweetens the atmosphere when you're polite to each other. I want you to be playful. Let laughter and joy and sex and happiness be mainstays of your marriage. Let's go to verse 33. The deceit trap. The deceit trap. Again, you've heard that it was said by those, said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all. Neither by heaven, for it's God's throne, nor by earth, it's his footstool, dropping down. Let your yes be yes, your no be no. Just tell the truth. Why do you think people lie to their spouses? I want you to decide right now that you'll never lie to your husband, that you'll never lie to your wife. I'm never going to tell you a lie. Why do you think we do that? Why do you think we lie to our spouses? The answer is because we don't want to live in the house with somebody who will censure us for our faults. I don't want to live with somebody who knows my faults and is going to tell me about them. It's the same thing about when you were a kid, you tried lying to your parents. Never worked. You know, mom's got those eyes back here in the back of her head. But you tried it because there was a logic attached to it. You felt like as a child that it would be profitable for you to tell a lie, that things would work out better for you with your mama or your daddy if you told a lie than if you told the truth. Well, we haven't gotten too far from that with our spouses. But I'm going to tell you what, marriage is based on trust. And if your spouse ever starts feeling like you can't be trusted, then you'll have to build that marriage back before joy can re-enter your house. Never lie to your spouse. Now, let's go to verse 38, the retaliation extractor. Now, I don't even know what a retaliation extractor looks like. I made that up. But here's what Jesus says. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And the point is that Christians are different. We don't practice retaliation. If somebody does something, if somebody curses us, we don't curse them back. We're different. We don't practice retaliation. You say, well, I know that. I'm a Christian. I know all about that. Great. What about your marriage? Wouldn't it be something if we subtracted retaliation from the way that we treat our spouses? How are we doing on that? You know, I mean, you take a marriage counselor and a couple comes in and you say to the pair, so what's the problem? And she says, he hit me. 9 times out of 10, you're going to turn to him and say, you hit her? And he's going to say, yeah, but she hit me first. Now, the root of that is that he feels like he had license. He had permission to do that because she did it first. You do that? Oh, I don't mean the hitting part. I don't mean that. But haven't you had evenings where you both get home and maybe she has PMS and she says something ugly to him? And or maybe he's just had a tough day at work and he's not really mad at her. He's just mad at the job and about what happened, and he's so tired and he's just critical, crabby. He says something kind of ugly. And how does she respond to that? Well, it hurts her. So she says something crabby back to him, only a little bit worse, because she wants to pay him back and teach him not to do that anymore. And it rather escalates. It's very much like an auction. My kids are grown. When they're at home, they would say, "Daddy, guess what I won on eBay?" I love that. I was, it's like you're willing to pay more for this item than anybody in the whole world, right? So you won it. That's pretty neat. You know why people have auctions? It's because, and you know what? I've done it. I love to go to auctions. Mrs. Collie and I like to go to estate auctions, particularly in Tennessee. Tennessee has the best auctioneers in the world. Some of them go to school, you know, and they kind of sing an auction. It's great. And you say, "I'm going to buy that. I'm going to bid on that, and I'm going to buy it." And you start bidding, and you bid up, and you bid up, and you bid up, and somebody bids where you planned to stop, and then you don't. And when it's over, you realize that you paid more than it was worth, and you say, why did I do that? And the answer is, you got caught up in the auction, and you just bid too high. And sometimes it's that way with our wives or our husbands. We get in a little tiff. And we just, it just escalates, and before long you say something awful. And she says, "You've been thinking that all along." And you really haven't. You just got caught up in the auction and you bid too high. That's what happened. You didn't mean it. Jesus says, "Don't retaliate." So what would happen? Will this revolutionize our marriages? If when one of us is a little bit terse and says something that's not very nice, what if we just didn't retaliate? I'm going to tell you something right now. It's very difficult to have a really good argument with somebody who won't participate. All right? Here's the last one. I'm calling it the conditional love expander. Verse 43. "You've heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you, do good to those that hate you, pray for those which despitefully use you and persecute you." And he taught us a love. He taught us how to love even our enemies. And that doesn't feel exactly right, because I would much rather just love the people who can benefit me. It's a whole lot easier to love a puppy than one of those Rottweilers. Because a puppy loves you first. That Rottweiler will bite your leg off, right? And so a boy says, "I'm getting married." Really? That's him right there. "Yes, sirree." "Well, that's fine. Do you love her?" "Do I love her? Yeah, I love her. Yeah, I love her. Let me tell you something. She's beautiful. I mean, that figure, she drives me crazy. She's beautiful. And I'll tell you something else, too. She can cook. Oh, she's a great, wonderful cook. And one more thing. You know, her daddy has this very lucrative position at the plant, and he's going to get me in on the ground floor, and I'm going to climb the ladder, and I'm going to, yeah, I love her. Of course I love her." Great. That's wonderful. And so they marry. A couple of weeks, he comes to this realization that wasn't her doing that cooking. It was her mother. And she can't cook. She can't boil water without burning it. She can't cook. And what happens if you're married for a little while and there's some, God forbid, some terrible accident, and that beautiful face, that beautiful figure, it's not so beautiful anymore? What if there's a big layoff at the plant and her dad and mama want to come live with you? I want to ask you a question. Do you love her? Do you still love her? See, love isn't about just when I get something. Jesus taught us how to love selflessly. When I was a boy in school, there was this phrase, going all the way. I don't know if kids say that anymore. I don't know. I'm not around kids who do. At least they don't say it to me. I'm a preacher. That was the problem, you know, of course, with those kids, is that they didn't go all the way. They went part of the way, and they debauched something that is very precious and designed for marriage. I want to create a mental picture for you. And you've seen this. You've seen this picture already sometime in your life. Maybe you can identify with it right now. They've been married for over 60 years. And she's very frail now. She's been sick a long time. And her little body, why, she doesn't weigh 90 pounds. And those legs of hers are, well, they're sort of twisted. And she's never going to get out of that bed on her own power anymore. And her mind, you know, Alzheimer's has worked on her mind. And it's not so terribly uncommon for her to look her husband square in the eye and say, "Excuse me, sir, could you get my husband for me? I need to talk to him," because she does not know who he is. And do you know what he's going to do? He's going to put a cot there by her bed. That's where he's going to sleep in case in the night she needs him. He's going to wash her and clean her and feed her and hydrate her. He's going to talk to her. And do you know how long that old man's going to do that? He's going to do it until one of those people gently puts the hand of the other into the hand of Jesus. Now you listen to this old preacher. That's going all the way. That's what you must do. And the way you do it is first by saying, "I'm going to follow Jesus. And I'm going to take these principles that make a man or a woman a faithful Christian. And I'm going to do, God help me, I'll do everything I can in my power to apply that to how I treat my spouse." And I'm here to tell you, I mean, I can guarantee you by the Word of God, God will bless your home and give you music for your marriage. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.